The talk this afternoon is on Kshanti Paramita, the perfection of patience, and I'm looking at my notes. I have 39 pages. So, and then I realised why I've got so many pages. It's to make you really practice patient endurance. I was saying earlier today, if I was a real Buddhist teacher, I'd come in here and annoy you and really test your patience. But because I want people to like me, I'm too weak and can't do that. So instead, I'll just give you a long talk on patience. So if you find yourself getting irritated with me, that is, you know, that you have to deal with. It's nothing to do with me. So, opportunity to practice Kshanti. So, this is about Kshanti Paramita. So, I've spoken more than once about the genuinely heroic nature of our endeavour. The Buddhist path, the Bodhisattva path, is demanding. It demands all of us. There's no question of that. There's much to work on, much to change, much to transform and to develop in ourselves for the benefit of others. And those others, of course, are infinite, an unending sea of beings in all kinds of states, states of suffering and woe, with all sorts of different needs. It's hard enough to begin to contemplate that. It's hard enough to even bring people to mind who we know, who we're in touch with. They can seem, those that we know, sometimes, there's not just a lot of them, they can seem sometimes so complex, so difficult, so weird, and our attitudes towards them can seem complex and difficult and weird. It all can all seem sometimes so overwhelming and challenging. It's easy to lose heart. We need to rouse that energy that does not lose heart that I spoke about in the Virya talk. But we'll also, there's also a great need to cultivate Kshanti. We need to perfect Kshanti, which means patience, forbearance, endurance, even tolerance. In the traditional list, it's the third of the six paramitas. It comes after Sila Paramita and before Virya Paramita. When I was younger, I always used to wonder why Kshanti was listed. Why not love? Why not metta? Why not karuna? Why not compassion? But I must admit, and I always used to find Kshanti Paramita a bit boring, you know, as a topic. I thought, oh, you know, this doesn't sound very exciting, really. It sounds just like hard work. But I must admit, as I've got older, especially in more recent years, I've begun to see how important Kshanti is. And I've come to appreciate that it's a much broader virtue, in a way, than metta and karuna. A much broader virtue. And indeed, I realised in preparing this talk that it's an extremely deep and rich area indeed. And I think my talk won't begin to do the topic justice. You could have a whole retreat, actually, on Kshanti Paramita. Bhante, in his lecture from the Bodhisattva Ideal, speaks of Kshanti as one of the most beautiful words in the whole vocabulary of Buddhism. It links a number of associated meanings so that there is no one English word which can do it full justice. It literally means patience or forbearance, and it is the antidote to anger. As well as the absence of anger and the absence of the desire for revenge, Kshanti has overtones of love, compassion, tolerance, acceptance, and receptivity. It also includes gentleness and docility, and there is even a suggestion of humility. We could probably, in a way, perhaps I could just read that and stop, and you can just go off and talk about that, but you've all turned up, so I'll carry on. We're dealing here with a very, very rich virtue and quality indeed. And Kshanti is explored in great depth and detail in Buddhist texts. It's spoken about even in early Buddhism. The Buddha talks about Kshanti with the famous verse, "Forbearance is the greatest ascetic practice, or patient endurance is the greatest ascetic practice. The word for asceticism is tapasya, which literally means making heat. And it was, of course, very important in the Buddha's day. Harming the body, putting up with great extreme physical privation, enduring patiently extreme physical privation, was regarded as a spiritual practice. It was regarded as making spiritual heat, burning up the defilements. But the Buddha, who had of course done all that, and which of course he rejected, saw that it's actually forbearance in relation to the pains of life, in relation to ill treatment by others, that is the greatest tapasya. That's how you really burn up the defilements. Not giving in to anger and resentment. That's the real ascetic practice. You don't need to physically harm yourself. Life itself, if you fully engage with it, if you fully engage with other people, if you really engage with them, you will have plenty of opportunity for patience and forbearance and endurance and tolerance, and therefore with ascetic practice. You don't need to do anything other than that. So many things in life could provoke in us irritation, frustration, which lead to anger and resentment and hatred, together with their very ugly brothers and sisters and cousins, like jealousy and envy and cynicism and so on and so forth. There's plenty of circumstances in life whereby these things could arise. Now, these states of mind that I've mentioned are the direct opposite of bodhicitta. They're the polar opposite. In Mahayana literature, anger and hatred are regarded as the worst possible states of mind in a bodhisattva. In Mahayana literature, they're quite forgiving in relation to greed and craving and so on, but very, very unforgiving of anger and hatred in ourselves. It's said that anger, even one moment of anger, can destroy all the merit that one has accumulated through worshipping the Buddhas and through ethical practice. The Mahayana speak that strongly about anger and hatred. Just one moment of anger can destroy it all. And why is that? Because it means a bodhisattva is cutting himself off from others. In anger and hatred, he's no longer embracing living beings. At least in craving, there is a connection with others, but with hatred, the connection is broken and severed at that time, at that moment. The connection is broken and severed. And if you've expressed that anger, it might actually lead to a severance with people that's impossible to heal the rift. Of course, there is rationalization possible here about craving. People might say, well, it's okay, I can, you know, love as many people in a, you know, in that craving sort of way. I can just do all that and hold them in my embrace and there should be no problem. But it's worth noting, Dharmapriya is nodding, it's worth noting that I'd like to note that I've seen plenty of times, have to say in our own order and movement, how indulgence in craving, especially sexual craving, has been the cause of a lot of damage and division between people. I've seen a lot of disharmony between order members, and mitras, because of craving. And I've seen this craving cause a lot of anger and hatred between people, affecting not just the people involved, but lots of other people as well. And seen how incredible amount of time and energy has been taken up to do with you know, stems for people not reining in their desire. Incredible energy which could caught up with that, which detracts from the bodhisattva work. So we actually need to beware of craving too, that can and desire, because that can actually in the end start cutting us off from others. I want to talk about some fields, as it were, of kshanti. First of all, there's kshanti, patience, in relation to ourselves. Firstly, in relation to our body. This means patiently enduring the aches and pains, the illnesses that are just part and parcel of having a body. It's important to look after the body, of course, and care for it. The human body is extremely precious. It's our support for our spiritual life. But no matter how much care we take over it and take with it, it will get ill, it will hurt, and it will, yes, in the end, break down. Even Buddhas can't avoid the breakdown of the body. It will age and wither. And we need to positively endure this process. And it's easy to get into a negative state when the body is ill or in pain or breaking down. We can get frustrated. We can even get frightened by that. I was so very, very moved spending time with my father in his last days. He had all sorts of things wrong with him, kept alive by a poisonous mixture of various drugs. But he was very really suffering. And every time I went to see him, he died last year, last August. Every time I went to see him, there was always something else that had happened. Something else had gone wrong. Even though mentally he was still very, very good, and I could see in him at times fear and confusion. And a lot of the time, intense frustration. Just feeling so frustrated. You know, I could hear him sometimes that he'd go up to bed and I'd stand behind him as he went up the stairs to make sure he didn't fall. I could hear, you know, his breath would be very laboured, and I could hear him mutter sometimes, "I've had enough of this. I've had enough of this." Or sometimes he'd just sit in his bed and just shake his head and say, "Nobody can tell me what's wrong with me. Why am I like this?" And I'd say, "Well, Dad, I think it's called old age." And he said, "There are other old men who aren't like this." And he was really puzzled. Or sometimes even catching him, you know, just privately weeping, just sobbing and muttering about how useless he felt, how useless. Actually, we loved him so much. He was a very, very wonderful presence for us all. So we didn't regard him as useless, but he'd been a working man all his life. And to feel his body breaking up like this and just not able to do things, not even able to make a cup of tea, not able to do the washing up, where he just felt that was the end. It was really heart-rending to see that. He did at times find a kind of peace in it all. Sometimes I'd sit with it, which I think said a lot for his the way he'd lived his life. I'd sit with him sometimes, and he would have a real sense of humour about what was going on. He could sort of laugh a bit at himself and reminisce very positively about his life. But he needed so much reassurance, I found, and a lot of patience actually from people looking after him. And it was very, very hard for my mother. It was very, very difficult. Just seeing him deal with all this, just the simple activity of, you know, not being able to dress himself, not being able to undress himself, not to be able to, you know, get into bed or get out of bed without help. An incredible, incredibly undermining. So we need to cultivate patience in relation to this. And the cultivation of this aspect of patience involves reminding ourselves continuously that having a body means that we will get ill, we will age, and we will suffer through that. We need to recognise that, and we need to open up to that fact. There's a great resistance to doing that. There's a great resistance to really acknowledge that. So, of course, when these things happen, especially when old age comes, we are unprepared. And we haven't cultivated the inner wealth, the inner riches, to face this breakdown. And that can involve anger and frustration and bitterness and, yes, the opposite of kshanti. There's nothing more tragic, I feel, than seeing someone's last years eaten up in bitterness. Thankfully, my father wasn't like that. he had a great nobility about him in relation to all this. But there's a neighbour who comes and sits with my mother, who's an old woman, and she's so bitter with her life. It's very, very sad to see. And I think that is a lack of kshanti, a lack of patience, forbearance. The Buddha in his early life realized that because we're so intoxicated with health and youth and life, we feel disgusted and humiliated when we see illness, aging and death. We blot out illness, aging and death. We block out illness and aging and death. Because we don't want to know, we don't want to accept that all this will happen to us. We don't want to know that. So even developing patience in relation to our body and its ailments, will involve opening up to others, to their bodily sufferings. There's a friend of mine who I would say he's very prone to arrogance and intoxication, especially with his intellect. There's nobody here, by the way, so don't start thinking it's about yourself. He's also a very impatient, quite angry person. And he came to see me a while back, and I noticed there was something a bit different. I was sort of not looking forward to seeing him, because it can always be a bit hard work. But I've got quite a strong connection with him, so we needed to meet. And there was something very different about him. And he started to tell me that he'd been working as a carer for the elderly. And I thought, and he said, you know, it's really humbling me. And I noticed he was much, much softer, much more open, more patient, more receptive. And he said, it's just so humbling working with people with Alzheimer's disease, or who just can't look after themselves. And I reflected on this, and I wondered if it was because on some level he was realising that this would happen to him. You know, so when you start recognizing that, you start to soften, you start to become more humble, you start to develop greater patience. The second aspect of patience in relation to ourselves is patience in relation to our spiritual progress and spiritual practice. This is an aspect of patience recognized in the tradition itself. It is understood and acknowledged that spiritual life, practicing the Dharma, involves hardship. They say, you know, worshipping the three jewels, that's doing pujas and all that sort of thing. Well, there's a kind of hardship in that. Begging your food if you're a monk, well, there's a hardship in that. They kind of list all the things you put up with. And it's the same, I'm sure, for you. Practicing the Dharma involves hardship. You put up with that hardship, with that difficulty, without resentment, you patiently endure that. Some of you, you know, just travelling to a retreat can be hard work. Some of you have travelled a very long way to be here, and maybe that wasn't a very smooth journey. You've had to travel far, you've had to pay out a lot of money, you're sharing a dormitory with, you know, perhaps people whose cleanliness isn't like yours. There's the daily routine of, you know, getting up to meditate. There's the routine of worshipping the Buddhas and listening to long talks and sitting in discussion groups, and sometimes the discussion you find rather boring, or, you know, some of the people in the group rather irritating. Day in, day out, year after year of spiritual practice of these kinds. And if you're serious, of course, if you're very serious, it will take you, your spiritual practice, into all kinds of difficult situations. And sometimes we can resent that, sometimes get angry with that, as if somehow it shouldn't be like that, as if it ought to be smoother and easier. We even start to fantasize, well, it would be better somewhere else. Why don't I, you know, try another Buddhist group, or another, you know, spiritual group, another religion altogether. Let's try something else. We even sort of blame others. You know, why can't those order members just arrange it in a better way? They sort of made it so, just, it was deliberately difficult for us. I mean, I've sometimes, you know, sat sometimes in lectures and things like that and thought, God, why are you going on like that? You're just, you know, you're just doing it deliberately to get at me. But the fact is, wherever you go, spiritual practice, if it's real spiritual practice, if it's a real training, will involve putting yourself out and putting up with hardship. And we need to learn to tolerate that, patiently endure that. One of the things that's going on in spiritual practice is that our self-view is being attacked and undermined. We're engaging in something that's, you know, which involves change for us. I remember some order members used to say, you know, I don't go on all the weekends because it interrupts my routine. And I have a very dear friend, Arlo, who used to say, well, that is precisely why you ought to go on all the weekend. Because actually, it's not just the routine, you're probably in a rut. And this is very blunt, Arloka, and usually get, you know, that you know, just breaking up your routine is a very good thing. If we're frustrated and angry with our, you know, the arrangements for our spiritual practice, it probably comes from a naivety. At the back of our minds, there's probably some naive idea that life should be smooth and nice and comfortable, and that spiritual life should be smooth and nice and comfortable. Well, sooner or later we need to get real and realise, well, it just isn't like that. Life isn't like that, and spiritual life isn't like that. So kshanti in relation to spiritual practice means being like the earth, emotionally stable and firm and even in relation to the ever-changing challenges and demands of spiritual life. I love the story, in case, you know, you find sometimes it all a bit demanding. I love the story of Longchenpa's guru, Kumaradza. Longchenpa, great Nyingma master, hugely significant in the development of, if you like, Nyingma thought and practice, where his teacher was the teacher he was told to seek out, the great master of Ati Yoga, Dzogchen, was somebody called Kumaradza. And he heard Kumaradza with his disciples, his yogis, dwelling on the snow line in the Himalayas. So he found him and took teachings from him and joined in retreat. But as soon as he'd settled down, Kumaradza says, right, we're off, we're going somewhere else. So they went somewhere else, difficult place. And as soon as they'd found water, as soon as they'd found shelter, as soon as they'd found the place to get firewood and food, as soon as they got comfortable, Kumaradza says, right, we're going somewhere else. And this is what happened. This is how they had to practice. He just, whenever they got comfortable, and that meant just getting the basics of life, we're going somewhere else. Total, constantly, you know, breaking up, you know, their settledness. And in this way, of course, they develop very, very deep patience and equanimity. Another aspect of this patience in relation to spiritual practice, our spiritual practice, is not getting angry with ourselves at our failings, at our lack of progress and so on. It's hard enough to transform ourselves, but it will make it even harder if we get angry at ourselves and if we give in to self-despising and all that sort of thing. Indeed, Shantideva says self-despising is a form of laziness. But it's also, of course, a manifestation of impatience. It's true, the Bodhisattva ideal is a very high ideal. It's the highest ideal. It's the highest ideal that I've ever come across. And I've spoken of the arising of bodhicitta in very exalted terms. And we can, of course, compare ourselves with that, and that can be very, with that ideal, and that can be very dispiriting at times. We could become self-disparaging about that, which is not the same thing as healthy self-criticism. It's a different thing. Self-disparagement, self-despising is very different from a healthy, balanced, critical appraisal of oneself. So we need to recognise and keep reminding ourselves of our qualities and of the progress that we've actually made. There is something of the bodhicitta in us. Kindness and clarity are there to some extent. So we need to recall and remember the good that we do. We need to recognise the sprouts of bodhicitta, the little soft, delicate, but nonetheless thrusting sprouts of bodhicitta within us. And we need to treasure and cherish then that's how they're going to draw forth. So we need to be really patient with ourselves and how we're getting on, and not give into anxiety about our progress and get angry with ourselves. The great Patril Rinpoche, another great Nyingma Lama, once said in an incredibly direct teaching to one of his disciples. Actually, I think it might have even been to himself, where he keeps saying, "Give up this and give up that," very self-critical. But at the end, he says, "Give up everything. That's the whole point. But don't get angry with yourself, even if you can't practice the Dharma. Don't get angry with yourself." So related to this, I think, is this aspect of patience is humility. You know, humility in the sense of, you know, just being comfortable in a way where we are, in a positive way, and learning to be receptive to ourselves and to the Dharma, and being willing to learn about our things, learn about ourselves. And about the Dharma, there's a whole area there which one could go into, but we don't really have time for that. So in these ways we develop patience in relation to ourselves. And this is all very important. All these different aspects of patience I've mentioned are very important. Another area of patience is just, you know, life itself. Today the thunderflies are in town. You know, all that little itching, that's not fleas, that's these little flies that come out in this very humid weather. And one can get very, very irritated and with them. It's a great opportunity to practice patience, Kshanti. It's just one of those things in life that happens. And they've been especially arranged by the Bodhisattvas at Padmaloka for our benefit, so that we can practice Kshanti. So when you feel them crawling up your nose in meditation, just be serene. This is the Bodhisattvas, they are Bodhisattvas teaching us Kshanti Paramita. And when you know how to do that, please tell me. So there are these different arenas of patience, but the main arena of patience that's mentioned is in relation to other people. It's here that the Bodhisattva really has to work. And to help us to identify the sorts of people, the kinds of situations where we need to work, I want to read some verses from a celebrated text of Tibetan Buddhism, from the 8 verses for training the mind by Geshe Langri Tangpa. Langri Tangpa was a spiritual descendant of Atisha, and his 8 verses to train, these 8 verses to train the mind are to train the mind in the development and cultivation of bodhicitta. So I'm going to read, in a way, what are sometimes regarded the heart of the text, verses 4, 5 and 6. I'll read each verse and then I'll comment on it. So this is verse 4. "When I see ill-natured people overwhelmed by wrong deeds and pain, may I cherish them as something rare, as though I had found a treasure trove." So when I see ill-natured people overwhelmed by wrong deeds and pain, may I cherish them as something rare, as though I had found a treasure trove. So this is just the generality of ill-natured people. Rough, crude, unskillful people. Whenever I read this verse, I always think of my experiences on arriving at Alicante Airport after being on retreat at Guhyaloka. There at Guhyaloka on retreat, whether a solitary retreat or an ordination retreat, I've been doing lots of pujas, dedicating the merit to all beings, doing metta bhavana to all beings, really in touch, apparently, with the inspiration of bodhicitta. There's great depth and refinement. And then when I get to Alicante Airport and I look at especially the British holidaymakers, they've got red faces, they look fed up, they're shouting at their children, they look very rough and... Well, sometimes, you know, when I see that, I'm a terrible confession. I'm just overwhelmed with disgust and misanthropy, and you know, just think, how can people be like this? And you know, and I have to catch myself because I'm thinking, hang on, you've been dedicating the merit for all beings. These are all beings. These are the all beings at the moment that you're actually with. And sometimes, you know, looking deeper, you know, trying to overcome that, well, you do see that they might look a bit rough, you know, they've been doing maybe lots of drinking and partying, and then sometimes you see the pain in the faces, you know, at the prospect of going home. And maybe it hasn't been a very good holiday. The thing they've looked forward to all year has actually not gone that well. Perhaps that's an example of what can happen. Practicing the Dharma, especially meditation, you can become more refined. You do become more refined. This is very pleasurable, of course, and very satisfying. So much so that we can find ourselves, if we're not careful, developing aversion to the coarseness that we perceive in others. There can be a disparity between our higher, more refined state of consciousness and what we encounter in others in the world. Langri Tampa is probably addressing yogis, hermits, probably people who don't often see, you know, the peasants in the village and the nobility in the palaces and things like that. But if we take the Bodhisattva when I wrote that, what came to my mind as well was a line from a great yogi named Jigme Lingpa, who said that a bodhisattva who lives in a valley as a hermit filled with poisonous snakes, you know, who's really into his meditation, if he's not careful, can develop overweening pride, can just become so conceited. And he's encouraging in this particular text this meditative being to come out into the world, into relation to people. If we take the Bodhisattva ideal seriously, we need to come into relationship with these coarse, ill-natured people, or who we regard as these coarse, ill-natured people. Of course, they might not be like that when we get to know them. We need to be prepared to put up with discomfort and with the roughness of it all. We need to develop patience in relation to all that. We need to develop a new mind in relation to all these people and see them as a treasure trove. But there's immense richness to be found among them and in them. But not only in them, in you, in us. First of all, we need to, if we can maintain a skillful state in relation to them, it means that we have to dig much deeper into our spiritual practice. And it means that we need to extend our practice so it isn't just reliant on retreat conditions. We also need to be not so precious about ourselves. We need to, you know, communicate with them, and in communicating with them, what will be brought forth will be a deeper, more essential understanding of the Dharma and how to express it. And I remember this very, very well from my experience of living and working in India, especially in Bombay, which is a very, very rough city, and I found it extremely challenging living in India, because it was so different from the refinement and safety of the West. And I lived for about a year very intensively in a flat in Bombay in a very rough part of town, and I very often had to give talks in slums, very rough, dirty, smelly places. Often I had to give talks by public urinals, and it was extremely demanding and difficult. Sometimes I had to give talks to very, very rough people, people who were drunkards and gamblers, and people in these, very often in these Hutment colonies, have very, very, very rough lives indeed. And when you have rough lives like that, you indulge in things which like heavy drinking and things like that. Sometimes I go to places and the order members would lean over to me and say, "You're going to have to give a strong talk here because there's a lot of drunkards in this locality." And that meant I had to give very strong Dharma talks about not drinking and things like that. Very basic morality. And I had to find a connection. I had to find a way of connecting with people. But actually, I think I've given some of my best talks in India, my very, very best talks, because I had to find a new way of communicating. I had to find, and that meant having to find a deeper understanding of the Dharma, a more essential understanding of the Dharma. And great richness, great inspiration came through in those situations. And not only that, I discovered that some of these people who seemed so sort of rough and ready, actually they were incredibly rich with great depth of experience. And some of those people, of course, you know, eventually became order members. When I go back to India these days, somebody will come up to me and say, "Hello, Padmavajra, do you remember me?" And I look a bit blank. "In 1987, you gave a talk in my locality and it changed my life. And now I am a Dharmachari." And, you know, incredible. But you just wouldn't think that to begin with. And sometimes I have to confess, I didn't have the patience. You know, I felt very impatient, very, very irritated being in these, you know, environments, and very impatient thinking, "I'm just not getting through, I'm just not getting it across." But that was my limitation. So in the West, I feel that we need to, all of us, myself included, we need to do more of this. We need to find ways to connect with different kinds of people. I was talking to an Afro-Caribbean Dharmacharini. She was doing a survey about connecting with Afro-Caribbean people. And I said, "Well, I probably feel okay. I can talk with Indians, and I probably feel okay with British Asians." I said, "But quite honestly, I wouldn't know how to communicate with, if I went to an Afro-Caribbean cultural centre or something like that. I'm not sure how I'd be able to connect, because I've never mixed with people like that." I had to confess that. And I think sometimes we hold back from communicating the Dharma to different kinds, different groups of people, because it means that we have to endure hardship. We think it will be very difficult. And maybe we're worried about being embarrassed or making mistakes and the humiliation that goes with that. But communicating the Dharma, making the Dharma known more widely, will involve the cultivation of kshanti. So I think there's a general point here about going out to communicate the Dharma, to befriend people with the Dharma, will involve hardship, and therefore it will need the cultivation of kshanti. We will need to endure, but we need to see the wealth in that. Bhante is a great example of this. In India, he was, you know, one of the great inspirations for me was, you know, the stories that people would tell me about Bhante in India when he was a young monk. I remember one Buddhist politician, quite a hard-headed man, went on a tour of a very, very poor area of Maharashtra, Ahmednagar district, and he said, you know, some of the monks who'd come before were very difficult. They wanted a car, they wanted special food, they needed a, you know, very comfortable living arrangements. He said, Bhante came, he didn't ask for any of that. He'd drink any water, he'd eat any food, he'd sleep on the floor, he'd sleep in, you know, very rough places. He didn't mind how he travelled. And he said, you know, and he was in tears talking about this. And, you know, I'm sure Bhante, you know, I'm sure sometimes he found it very difficult. But there was his overwhelming desire to communicate the Dharma. So the hardship didn't matter. He was able to put up with that. So that's general, the general kshanti in relation to, you know, difficult people, difficult situations to communicate the Dharma. But Langri Tangpa then becomes more specific in the fifth verse. "When someone out of envy does me wrong by insulting me and the like, may I accept defeat and offer victory to them." When someone out of envy does me wrong by insulting me and the like, may I accept defeat and offer victory to them. Sometimes this verse is regarded as the heart of Langri Tangpa's eight verses, and this "may I accept defeat and offer victory to them" was a great inspiration to another great Tibetan teacher named Geshe Chekawa. When he read "may I accept defeat and offer victory to them," he was just absolutely thrilled. He'd never come across this. He thought this sounded like marvellous teaching, to accept defeat and offer victory to others. And he based a whole scheme of teaching known as the Lojong, the mind training, which is very, very popular in Tibetan Buddhism, expounded by the lamas of all schools, he based this teaching around this verse. So here we're presented with a situation where someone is competing with us in some way or other. They insult us, they make little digs at our expense, they make little jokes maybe about us, they tease us. Maybe there's something even worse going on than that. They really are trying to hurt us. And of course, in normal life, we would feel justified in retaliating, in attacking them and criticising them, in paying them back. We feel that we have the moral high ground to do that. We'd be indignant, have righteous indignation. But Geshe Langri Tangpa says, no, may I accept defeat and offer victory to them. We don't retaliate. We don't get in for tit for tat. We don't pay back in kind. We let them have the victory. This doesn't mean, this doesn't mean that one becomes very meek and mild, letting people bully you and just walk all over you. I don't think it means that. What it means is that you don't interact on the level of that envy. Really, it means stepping outside of thinking in terms of victory and defeat. In practice, you would let them win. Sometimes, I don't know if you've ever noticed, sometimes you can get into a discussion and it gets tense. Maybe it gets competitive. And you feel you've got to keep your side up. You've got to keep your end up. But then you realise, you sort of know that if you keep going, it's going to lead to a very difficult situation. So it's like a kind of fight. And then you just think, no, don't. Let them win. Let them have it. It's okay. Let them have the victory. It's okay. That defeat is okay. Because there's a bigger victory for you. And that victory is over yourself. Over your egotism, your pride, your ill will. That's a much bigger victory. That's a much better thing to happen. So it might look as though you've lost. You've lost the argument in front of maybe other people. But you decide, no, it's much better that it looks like that. And I defeat the anger within myself. So it might look as though their power is victorious. But you're thinking of a different kind of victory. Defeat for you would be giving in to ill will. Defeat would be losing your loving kindness. I think this is related to that mysterious comment that you might have come across in Bhante's Ten Pillars of Buddhism, when he talks about love, the positive aspect of the first precept, as being like a pillar of diamond. And he says it's a pillar of diamond because love, the love mode, can never be destroyed, and it will always overcome the power mode. And people are often very puzzled by this, because they said, well, there's plenty of instances in history where people have been, you know, relating with love. People quote the Cathars, the Christians in the Languedoc, who were the good Christians, who were destroyed by the Inquisition and the Crusades. Because they didn't believe in violence. They believed profoundly in non-violence and the God of love. People say, well, that must have been a defeat. They were all burnt at the stake. The culture was wiped out. But for those Cathars singing hymns as they went to the stake, they were singing in joy because they had won. They had conquered the violence in themselves. Their love was triumphant. Love always overcomes the power mode because it doesn't think in terms of victory and defeat. It's stepped outside of that kind of relationship. So we give them the victory and we take the defeat on ourselves. Verse 6 of Langri Tangpa's text says, even if someone who I have helped and in whom I have placed my hopes does great wrong by harming me, may I see them as an excellent spiritual friend. Even if someone who I have helped and in whom I have placed my hopes does great wrong by harming me, may I see them as an excellent spiritual friend. This is another particularly painful situation and very, very pertinent, I think. You've helped someone. You've put a lot into the relationship. You've given them a lot. You've loved them a lot. You've cared for them. Maybe you've been their very good friend. Maybe you've been their Kalyana Mitra. Maybe you've been their preceptor. Maybe you've been their teacher. Maybe you've been their lover. Whatever. You've spent hours with them. You can think of your own examples of this. You've placed your hopes in them. And then they harm you. They criticise you. They reject you. They betray you. You've given so much, and because of that giving, you've assumed so much, you've hoped for so much, you've expected so much, and then they reject you. They reject what you've given them, they reject you. This is extraordinarily painful. And it happens, of course, in so many different situations in life. It happens between the parent and child. I think it must be incredible being a parent. Sometimes, you know, how demanding it must be when as the child grows up and maybe they turn on you. Maybe they turn on you and betray you. You've invested so much and then they just reject you. That must be extraordinarily painful for a parent. And it's an incredibly developed parent. Happens between lovers, doesn't it? Husband and wife, lovers. It can happen between teacher and disciple. I was reading about the relationship between Heidegger and Husserl, his teacher. Husserl invested so much in Heidegger. He regarded, you know, Heidegger as his heir, and he was going to be the heir of phenomenology. Husserl's great, great insight, philosophical insight. And then gradually, it started to dawn that Heidegger was starting to turn against Husserl. And reject Husserl. It must have been so painful, so difficult to be on the end of that. It's very, very painful, very humiliating. We feel when this happens that our world is breaking up, that our expectations are being shattered and broken. And of course, if they criticise us and turn on us, not just walk away from us, but actually turn on us, it's even worse. They're sort of adding insult to injury. And it's very hard not to see such a person as bad, as evil, as cruel. But Langri Tangpa, in classic Buddhist tradition, asks us to regard such a person as an excellent spiritual friend. They're a teacher. They're a guru. They're our real, true guru. They're greater even than all our gurus. They really push this sometimes, these Tibetan lamas, greater than any guru who gives you all the great initiations and the kindest of teachings is the person who really hurts you. That is the great teacher. And I guess this is strong medicine. I'm speaking about it quite strongly, but I must admit it's very hard teaching. Very, very hard dharma. There's many things to learn in this situation, especially you learn patience. Kshanti, forbearance, learning not to retaliate. You're not going to give in to anger and hate and revenge. You're not going to do that. It's teaching you also about refuge. It's teaching you about what can you actually rely on. Some have said, in recent years, some order members and mitras and friends have said that the various things that have come to light about Bhante, they felt betrayed, they felt that their expectations and hopes were let down, and they found that very difficult. But they've actually come to realise, those who I think who've been fairly mature with it all, that they've realised, well, what can I really rely on? What is the refuge? And of course there's this great teaching, which first time I heard it expounded was by Bhante himself, rely on the Dharma, not on persons. And the word for rely is related to the word for refuge. Rely on the Dharma, not on persons. So this is very, very important. We can place an inappropriate confidence in people. We can place an inappropriate confidence on people within the spiritual community, in others. But people change. Circumstances change. And when that happens, we can easily feel betrayed and let down. But I would say that feeling of betrayal and feeling let down, that indicates the state of our going for refuge. It indicates the degree of how much we've actually realised and internalised the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. It indicates the state of our bodhicitta, how much we're thrown by all that. And of course the temptation is to give up on people when they do this, is to give up even on the Sangha. You can feel so let down, you just want to give up. You can even become very cynical even about the idea of spiritual development and spiritual community. You can see that sometimes. The betrayal becomes the worst kind of betrayal. The worst kind of betrayal is betraying yourself, betraying your positive feelings about something. That's the worst betrayal of all. James Hillman, in a very famous essay on betrayal, speaks of it, betrayal, as an initiation into a new quality of consciousness. We're going to have to learn a new reliance, which is more to do with the actual nature of things. Bhante writes a bit about this himself. He experienced being thrown out of the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara as a betrayal. And in his booklet 43 years ago, he goes into that. He talks a bit about what it was like being thrown out. He'd relied on people. He'd trusted people. And he felt that they betrayed that trust by just ejecting him from the Hampstead Vihara. But he said that betrayal leads to going into the desert, leads to going into a kind of wilderness. But that's a wonderful place, the desert, where much becomes clear. You have to work out when you're betrayed. You have to work out your relationship to what has happened. You have to come to a deeper understanding of what's actually gone on, an understanding which does not undermine your spiritual ideals. You can feel when you're betrayed by another person that your whole world is falling apart, that your identity is utterly shattered and devastated. I've seen it, particularly in the breakup of romantic relationships. You know, when it ends, I've seen people utterly shattered and devastated. It's like their world has ended. Their world has ended. The thing is, it's not that person's fault. That's what Buddhist tradition is saying. No matter what they've done, it's not their fault. That's what we think. We think it's their fault. It's probably what other people think. But that's not what the Bodhisattva thinks. When someone does this, it's telling us something about my assumptions about life, my expectations about life. Bhante has written about this in a very, very pithy poem, which would be well worth going to read, called Life is King, about how we try to kind of control life, try to get the reward from people, try to have things our way, but we can never do it. Life is king, he says. Life just slips through your fingers. This is very poignant for us on the Bodhisattva path. We want to engage with people. We want to engage with many people very, very fully. You do that. But they never turn out quite as you hoped they would. You experience this so often. You're at a class and there are these wonderful beginners coming along and they're really enthusiastic and they're there every week. And they start maybe going along to the regulars class. And you think, great, it's wonderful. This is going to be great for our centre. And you can sort of in your mind's eye imagine them becoming, mitras and order members and your special spiritual friends and all the rest of it. And then they disappear. They don't come back. Or maybe they turn up and they've gone on the internet and found something and they start attacking you. Very, very difficult. And this happens when you're a Kalyana Mitra, when you're a preceptor. Perhaps especially when you're a preceptor. People never turn out quite as you expected. But this is a wonderful thing, actually. It's a wonderful thing, all this going on for us. It's very tempting to criticise them and feel disappointed when people don't turn out how you want them to. You can even say, I'm disappointed in you. But that's not the Bodhisattva spirit. And to voice that is, you know, says so much more about you than them. To be disappointed in someone suggests, implies, ego involvement and ego investment. Your giving is based on tit for tat. Your giving is conditional. You think it's been incredibly selfish, but selfless, but actually it hasn't been. You've wanted something back. You haven't been freely giving. So we have to be very careful, and especially if we're, you know, quite weighty, we've quite a lot of experience, we have to be very careful in expressing feelings like this to less experienced people. We need, actually, first of all, to recognise our investment, our self-interest. We need to give freely and open-endedly, and people must feel free to follow their conscience. That's the basis for spiritual life. This feeling of betrayal can happen in other ways as well. People have all sorts of expectations. There's all sorts of expectations about the ordination process. You do certain things in order to get ordained. Sometimes people say this, that you know, well, I've done all this and I'm still not ready. You know, you're doing things to, you know, perhaps win approval, perhaps to get a certain kind of status. And they're very upset when, you know, they're not given it. You know, it's not actually, you know, you're told you're not ready. But you've set up that up. You've set that expectation up. Sometimes I must admit I experience this, that I can't communicate with people properly because of the film of their expectations, if you like. There's this thing in the way. And so I can't actually meet them. There's this thing called, I want to get ordained. So I am being a certain way for you so that you can see what a wonderful person I am. And I just can't, you know, communicate. I don't want people to be like that. I just want to be them. Them is good enough. And I often feel disappointed because I haven't met their ideas of what I should be for them. And this is the stuff, of course, of the traditional, in the traditional guru-disciple stories. It's the stuff of it. You know, Marpa's always doing this with Milarepa, you know, build that tower, build, then I'll give you the teaching. He builds the tower and says, no, I must have been drunk when I told you that. Take it down and put everything back where you took it from. And there's Milarepa constantly being shown groundlessness, constantly being introduced to the groundless nature of things. When we feel betrayed and let down, it's very painful, but it's actually a wonderful thing. It exposes our illusions, that life should conform to our expectations and assumptions. And it's always going on. It's going to go on for a long time. There's going to be all sorts of refinements, you know, of it. Sometimes, you know, when you're an order member of many years standing, you can expect people, you know, to sort of come to you and listen to you just because you've been ordained a long time. But, you know, why should anybody listen to anybody? That's an expectation. And this is a sort of excuse to read something, in a way, a wonderful thing from the rabbinic tradition in Eastern Europe, from the Baal Shem tradition. And it's the words of Rabbi Jacob Yitzhak, who was consoling an unsuccessful colleague, another rabbi who didn't have so many disciples. And he said, but they come to me because I'm astonished that they come. And they do not come to you because you are astonished that they do not come. And I think that's so beautiful. It just shows it's really very much the spirit of the Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva is astonished that anybody would want to listen to him. Anybody would want to benefit from him because of the egolessness of his attitude. But if we're thinking, well, people should listen to me, and, you know, I'm special, well, we're getting it wrong. We might be let down repeatedly, but we don't really feel like that when we're really doing it. We're giving without strings. We love in a way without hope. We've given love not for any hope of return, but just for the sake of it. This is the sort of thing that Shantideva celebrates in the verses on Bodhicitta, about people, you know, mocking him, abusing him, and all that sort of thing. But he doesn't mind. It's not some weird masochistic thing. It's the lightness with which he holds himself. What's important is the bodhicitta and its expression, rather than what you get in return. So we need to work more on attitudes which seem to justify resentment and feelings of revenge in relation to betrayal. They let me down. Well, maybe they did, but so what? What did you do to buy into that situation? And in any case, does the anger actually help the situation? So we need to give as freely as we possibly can, and not be angry at apparent ingratitude. If we feel angry at apparent ingratitude, it means we haven't given freely. So this is another very, very powerful verse from Langri Tampa, and it draws attention to another of those moments when our sense of a separate self is likely to rise up very, very strongly. When that happens, we need to think. Even if someone who I have helped and in whom I have placed my hopes does great wrong by harming me, may I see them as an excellent spiritual friend. And it's just a little thought on as well about anger and resentment and things like that. Shantideva, in his discussions of anger and resentment, says, if you're an angry person, people will stay away from you. Sometimes I've met people who are quite angry and resentful, and they wonder, they're sort of puzzled, why can't I come into communication with people? And you sort of say, well, it's because of all these spikes that come out of you. People can't come into relation to you because of that. And it's also said, Shantideva also says, there is no way an angry person can be happy. So there's really something to reflect on there in relation to Kshanti. So we can see from all these examples that Kshanti is not simply a matter of forbearing and patiently enduring the pains of life. Kshanti must involve wisdom. If we're really going to do Kshanti, we need to develop a real wisdom about life. To endure is the beginnings of wisdom. To endure is the beginnings of seeing into the true nature of existence. To forgive someone, to truly forgive, and of course this is the positive aspect in relation to especially betrayal, to truly forgive, we will need to forgive not just the person, we will need to forgive life itself. We will need to accept with a huge capital A the nature of life, the nature of what it means to be alive. We need, to put it another way, to forgive things. To forgive things, to forgive the flow, the ever-changing, the groundless nature of life. Do we really resent clouds when they move and change? Do we resent the falling of rose petals? It's the way of things. And yet, even though these things happen, we continue to love, to give, to affirm. And this brings us to the highest patience of all, what's called the Anutpataka Dharma Kshanti, the patient acquiescence that all dharmas are unproduced, the patient acceptance that all dharmas are unproduced, that all things are birthless. The logic, as it were, behind this is that if everything is empty of substance and self-nature, of own being, how can anything arise? How can anything come into existence? How can there be a self and other? How can there be an inside and an outside? There's not nothing. There is rather a magical display. There's no thing called bodhisattva. There's no things called beings to save. There's no saving. There's no samsara.
there's no nirvana, there's no being let down by others, there's no egoistic involvement with others, there's just a flow of ceaseless, unself-conscious giving. This is the Bodhisattva's play. So everything is just this wonderful, creative, flowing display. And this kshanti is actually used as another word for wisdom in perfection of wisdom literature. Wisdom is not described here as a penetrating insight, but as patient acceptance, opening up to, becoming profoundly receptive towards what is, without all the filters and distortions that we bring to it. And of course we get there, we get to that point through awareness and loving kindness. This is called very, very profound, all this. It seems so far away, but if we can just begin to cultivate awareness, just seeing things as they are in themselves, with loving kindness, without all the biases and expectations, we're beginning to move towards the patient acceptance that all dharmas are unproduced. And of course, it begins, all this wisdom, all this kshanti in the profoundest sense, begins with the actual people around us. It begins with our family, our friends. It begins with the people around us at work. It begins with the people who come to the centre. It begins with the people we meet on retreat, especially the ones we find difficult in all these situations. It begins, it happens in the Sangha. So there's another reason why Sangha, why spiritual community is so important in our training as Bodhisattvas. So often within spiritual community we come up against, we really rub up against these other people and all the difficulties that go with that. So people with all their difficulties and our difficulties with them, that is where kshanti paramita begins, and of course where it ends as well.